Gaddafi's last stand. This morning, we'll take you on a journey to the besieged Libyan capital. After a week of violence, we're live in the middle of a revolution. We'll go into the streets and inside Gaddafi's mind with my exclusive interviews with his two powerful sons.
Do you think they'll get rid of you?
What is their father thinking right now? And how will he respond to President Obama's call for him to leave right away? And what will it all mean for your security, your gas tank, your life? And closer to home, states of emergency. A crisis that hits all of us. Where have the jobs gone? We'll ask four cash-strapped governors. Do they have a plan to save your house, your school, and your pension? A special edition of This Week, live from Libya, starts now.
Welcome to our viewers in the United States and around the world. From the heart of Gaddafi's stronghold, the Libyan capital, Tripoli, we're among a small group of journalists who've been invited in as the Gaddafi regime tries to put its stamp now on the unfolding story here. And as we try to sort fact from fiction, sometimes fact is so much stranger. Who could possibly invent the rants and the ravings of a leader like Colonel Gaddafi, the defecting Libyan Air Force pilots, the Libyan diplomats bursting into tears at the United Nations as they take a stand against their leader of 41 years? Now, the tough new sanctions and Gaddafi's increasing isolation are based on allegations that he has ordered airstrikes, bombing of civilian protesters. We have seen no evidence of that yet, and the Gaddafis strongly deny it. But journalists have been to hospitals and have seen gunshot victims. We've met people who are angry that protests have been met by live fire. There are special army brigades and tanks ringing the entrances to this capital. Also, confirmation that a town just 30 kilometers away is under opposition control. But there is a sense that Gaddafi can hold out here, at least in the short term, as we found out in our journey that began 24 hours ago.
We're on one of the few commercial flights from London into Tripoli, the capital of Libya. It's Gaddafi's last major stronghold. He's pulled out. We don't know what we're going to find. We've been asked by the government to come and see their side of the story. They say all is calm. We'll see when we get there.
Our plane was mostly empty, and when we landed, so was a grand airport VIP lounge. We found a big portrait of Gaddafi still adorning the wall. Proof that for now, the colonel still controls his capital. But just outside the lounge, a desperate scene as migrant workers from all over this region seek refuge and safe passage home.
Hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of people trying to get out, just hanging out here. They don't have tickets, most of them, and there's garbage and clothes strewn all over the place. It seems they've just come here because they're so unsure about what's happening in the city itself. How many days you been here?
I don't know, maybe 4 days, maybe 5 days.
With no money, no airline tickets, and little hope of making it onto a flight, these people have no idea how much longer they'll have to camp outside as mounds of garbage pile up beside them.
We've left that sea of humanity behind at the airport. There were some soldiers guarding the entrance to the airport, but now we're driving into Tripoli itself. And so far, there's no sign of any violence, of any conflict on this road.
After the eerie calm of the streets, a colorful neon welcome at the designated journalist hotel. A surreal scene, since we'd been told the city was now ringed with tanks and pro-Qaddafi forces. Earlier Saturday, reports that 500 miles to the east, cities along the Mediterranean coast had largely fallen. Tens of thousands of anti-government demonstrators celebrated there in Libya's second largest city, Benghazi.
I've never been as happy as today in my whole life.
And they were not alone. All along the coast, they were firing guns into the air, taking control of a radio station, even mocking and impersonating their leader of more than four decades. All this as after a week of protests and violent reprisals, President Obama issued a statement saying that Gaddafi needs to do what is right for his country by leaving now. I sat down for exclusive interviews with Gaddafi's sons, First, I spoke to Saif al-Islam, who is also one of his chief advisors.
Thank you for joining us. The President of the United States, President Obama, has called on your father to step down. What do you think about that?
First of all, it's not an American business. That's number one. Second, do you think this is a solution? Of course not.
Says if a person can only keep control by using force, then legitimacy is gone.
Right. But what happened? We didn't use force. Second, we still have people around us. So we are in Tripoli. In Tripoli, you have here half of the population of Libya. The half. Like more than 2.5 million people living in this city. Do you think because of 10,000 or 5,000 people, they have a legitimate, even if they have a legitimate demands or against my father or whatsoever, it means that the whole Libyan population is against Mr. Gaddafi?
You said that you're not using violence, but there are many reports of helicopter gunships, of people being killed, and also Air Force pilots defecting, jettisoning their planes rather than carry out orders to bomb citizens.
Show me a single attack. Show me a single bomb. Show me a single casualty. The Libyan Air Force destroyed just the ammunition sites.
What do you make of your diplomats in New York, for instance, in Washington, who are resigning because they're saying they can't abide this policy?
Yeah, I talked to them.
Why do you think so many people are deserting your father?
He thought, and many of them, that the system is going to collapse. So the best thing is to jump from the ship. The ship is sinking, they think, so it's better to jump.
Will there be a new regime?
If you are strong, they love you. If not, they say goodbye. And it's good, we get rid of them. Hypocrites.
Do you think they'll get rid of you?
No. They are the losers. They have no future. They want to join the youth revolution.
What's the plan? What is your plan? Are you staying? Are you going? What's your father's plan? Is he staying? Is he going?
Listen, nobody is leaving this country. We live here, we die here. This is our country. The Libyans are our people. And for myself, I believe that I am doing the right thing.
Before all this happened, you were known, certainly in the West, for being a reformer, speaking the language of reform for Libya. But it didn't happen. Why did it take this kind of crisis for you to start talking about reform again? Wouldn't it have been better to have implemented what you're talking about now, before?
Of course, it was a big
mistake. So why not?
It was a big mistake not to move fast. I was shouting every day about this. I was crazy about going fast and implementing the reforms in the right time. I worked very hard to go, to implement many ideas, but things went wrong. So now we are in a difficult situation. And the people who were responsible for that, stopping me from going forward, they are the same people who I see them every day on the TV saying, bye-bye, we are going with the next group. The same faces, the same people.
Are you afraid at all?
Afraid of what? The point that you are hearing rumors, false reports, please take your camera tomorrow morning, even this night, go to every city in Libya. Everything is calm, everything is peaceful. The point is there is a big, big gap between reality and the media reports.
Saif, I'm going to ask you a question.
Yes.
You say there's a big, big gap between reality and media reports. Some might say there's a big, big gap between what you're thinking and saying to me and the reality around the rest of Libya.
Why the whole South is calm, the West is calm, the Middle is calm, even part of the East.
What do you make of the international community's reaction? There are calls to have heavy sanctions, to freeze your assets, your father's assets, family assets.
First of all, we don't have money outside. We are a very modest family, and everybody knows that. And we were laughing when they said we have money in Europe or Switzerland or so. It's a joke.
A few hours later, we went to talk to Gaddafi's son, Saadi, who's lived many years outside this country, used to play football for an Italian team. We reached him just as news emerged of fresh UN sanctions against his family.
Overnight, Libya time, the United Nations slapped sanctions on this country and a travel ban. How is that going to affect you?
The travel issue, this has bothered me so much because I spent most of my life in traveling, you know.
So what's in your immediate plans if you can't travel?
I'm going to hire a lawyer. I have some hobbies after I quit football. I have some hobbies like I do some hunting, I go to safari. So in Libya there's no safari, so I gotta go to safari, I gotta hire a lawyer.
You gotta get out of Libya.
I mean, I would like to live normal.
The people here say they would like to live normally. They want normal freedoms, they want a normal life. And they haven't had it.
No, they have.
You think so?
Yeah, but the people, everybody wants more. There is no limit. You give this, then you get the ask for that. You know.
What do you think is happening to your region?
Earthquake.
An earthquake?
An earthquake. It's a fever. It's going to spread everywhere. No one will stop it. This is my personal opinion. And the chaos will be everywhere.
You think it'll be chaos, or you think it'll be a fever of freedom and democracy?
No. They think it's about freedom. Everybody loves freedom. I love freedom. You love freedom. But it's much powerful, this earthquake. No one can control it.
Will your father leave?
I think it's if he has to leave today. If he leaves today, just one hour later, local war, civil war in Libya.
You've traveled a lot. You've lived in other countries. When you see the kind of life, the kind of freedoms, the kind of democracy that other people have, did it make you think that people here should have it? How did you feel about coming back here and people didn't have it?
This is the main thing. This is the main issue for me. This thing is bothering me every day.
Is it hard being Gaddafi's son?
I have to deal with it. I would like to be myself. I would like to be just Saadi.
My exclusive interviews with Colonel Gaddafi's two sons, Saadi and Saif, and you heard them both dismiss the fact that lots of this country has fallen to the opposition. We're now going to my colleague Jeremy Bowen of BBC, our partner station, who has just returned from Zawiya, not far from this capital. Jeremy, who's in control of Zawiya?
Well, Christiane, the center of Zawiya has, I would say, demonstrators there today. Oh, a couple of thousand who were in the main square. They've got a tank. They've got some heavy weapons there as well. And they're in control of that part of the town. Now, bizarrely, the Libyans brought us to this particular place. And we saw there that they were in control, having what they called a revolution of honor. So now the Libyans have taken us to see various counter-demonstrations. At this moment, we're stopped in the middle of the highway where there are people in pickups and waving green flags and portraits of Colonel Gaddafi and expressing their great loyalty to him. But Zawiya, the center, is in the hands of rebels.
And does it look like they're preparing to push forth towards us here in Tripoli, towards the capital?
Oh, no, they don't have that kind of capability. I use the word rebels. What they are local guys in the main, I'd say. I spoke to lots of people there, to police officers who changed sides. There were some doctors, just regular people from that particular town. They've set up a little first aid station in the mosque. They've burnt down the Institute for the Study of Colonel Gaddafi's Green Book. But they point out proudly that next to it, the bank has been left untouched. They're all local people there. They have no plans to push, no ability to push forward towards Tripoli. What they're trying to do is hang on to what they have.
Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us and giving latest news from there. Welcome back to Tripoli. And as the world tries to make sense of these lightning movements that are sweeping this part of the world, the Arab and Muslim world, we're also trying to figure out what this means for the United States, for its strategic interests, and how new shaping order over here will shape the United States economy and all sorts of other strategic interests. So join me now from Washington to discuss this is author Reza Aslam, political strategist Robert of the Brookings Institution, and our own senior White House correspondent, Jake Tapper. Thank you all for joining me. Jake, I want to ask you first, as so many Americans are trying to figure out what this all means. All the revolutions now sweeping from Tunisia to Egypt and whatever may unfold here. How should Americans make sense of this, Jake?
Well, obviously, there are different levels to look at it. There is the American ideals of democracy that have eluded much of that part of the world, but then there's also American strategic interests, which it's a double-edged sword what's going on in the Middle East right now in North Africa. There's obviously a great deal of oil and energy that we get from that region, and unrest will upset oil prices and cause Americans pain at the pump. There are other national security, counterterrorism issues. We have a lot of cooperative relationships with a lot of dictators in that region. But ultimately, I think that the way that the American people have to look at this is in terms of the American ideals and how democracy needs to take hold throughout that part of the world.
Let me move to you, Bob Kagan, because you've been studying this a long time. We've talked about this many times before. Is this good for the United States in the end? Are U.S. strategic interests best served by a democratic region here or by leaders who they think they can count on? And obviously we're talking about oil and strategic interests.
Well, it's an illusion to think that we have an option of supporting these dictators. I mean, we are now paying the price for supporting these dictators for three, in some cases, four decades. We have a foreign policy establishment in the United States in both parties. It's been very cozy with these dictators. And this has all been in the name of an illusory stability. There is no stability now. We're going to have to get used to the idea of change. There is a moment when you go from stability to change. We're not going to a new stability. But I think that we should have more faith than we've shown in the basic values that we believe are universal and which we have to understand that Muslims and Arabs share. Ultimately, yes, there's going to be some strategic setbacks. Yes, these governments may not agree with us as much as we like. But in the long run, I do think, just as it was in our interest for Europe to be democratic, for Asia to be democratic, it's in our interest for this part of the world to be democratic as well.
Well, let me move to Reza Aslan. You've studied a lot about the people who make up this part of the world. Who are these young people? Are they hostile to the United States? Are they friendly to the United States? What's causing them to rise up when previous generations did not?
Yes, ultimately, this can be described as a youth revolution. This is a region, some three quarters of which is under the age of 35, and they're not isolated from the rest of the world the way their parents were. They have satellite television, they have internet, they have social media, and the monopoly that these authoritarian regimes used to have over the levers of communication simply does not exist any longer. But this is a wonderful opportunity, I think, for a president who came to office saying that he wanted to reshape the relationship between the United States and the Muslim world. He's been given a gift on a platter. So the days in which, you know, we could waffle about whether we felt good about supporting these dictators or whether stability was more important than democracy, those days are over. The decision has been made for us, and it's now time to fully support the people of the region and to change the relationship, change the very narrative of relations between the U.S. and the Muslim world.
Okay, so one thing that certainly in the United States and in this region everybody's looking at is who is the net beneficiary. And many are saying that without lifting a finger, it is Iran. Bob Kagan, is Iran going to come out the winner?
Well, if you mean the Iranian regime, I think the answer is no. I find it very hard to believe that this ferment, this desire for freedom and democracy that's sweeping the entire region is going to bypass Iran. I think that, quite honestly, the Iranian leadership right now is living on borrowed time. And I hope that one thing that the Obama administration and President Obama personally recognizes is that when we didn't really come out in full-throated support of the Green Revolution after that fraudulent election, we made a mistake. And now it's time to get on the side of the Iranian people, just as we're trying to get on the side of the Libyans and Egyptians and others in the region. So I'm not worried that this is strengthening the Iranian regime. I think it, in fact, is putting it in some peril.
Jake, what do you think the White House is telling allies like Saudi Arabia and Bahrain? I mean, Saudi Arabia seems to be one of the last major allies that hasn't yet fallen. And of course, the huge strategic interests of oil there and terrorism, Al-Qaeda.
That's exactly right, Christiane. And the Obama administration has been sending out messages, not just to allies in the region, but to all countries in the region, that they need to get ahead of this movement. You've seen the King of Jordan try to get ahead of it, try to talk about pro-democracy reforms. You've seen other steps taken by the leadership in Yemen, Bahrain, Algeria, in which they're trying to take some steps to at least try to convince their people that they're on the side of reform, and has not always been convincing. But that's been the message they've been telling the Saudis, for example, to support reform efforts in Bahrain, which is so close to Saudi Arabia, of course, reform efforts that would include some power sharing with the Shia majority in that country, even though the kingdom is run by Sunnis. And this has not been an easy process. It's going to take a long time, but that's been the message coming from President Obama and the administration.
And Reza, just a last final word. Do you think, as everybody asks about Iran, that there is a tipping point coming to Iran as well or not?
Well, look, the economic situation that led to the uprisings in Tunisia and Egypt and elsewhere are far worse in Iran. I mean, the inflation rate in Egypt is 12%. In Iran, it's twice that. Higher unemployment rates, higher poverty rates in Iran. And certainly, well, let's not forget that the paradigm that was set about how to go about organizing in these kinds of authoritarian regimes began with the Green Movement. So everybody's waiting to see if what started in Iran in 2009 will end in Iran. That's hard to say. The regime has learned a lesson from what happened in 2009. But Bob's right. It's an untenable situation. The economy is on the verge of collapse. Mm-hmm. It's becoming increasingly isolated. Its nuclear program is in shambles. And I think change is coming to Iran, though it may not be the sort of profound revolutionary regime change that everyone is waiting for. I think that change is inevitable.
And many people, we touched briefly on Al-Qaeda. Bob Kagan, is this an opportunity for Al-Qaeda, these democratic revolutions that are sweeping around here, or democracy sweeping here? Is it an opportunity for Al-Qaeda, or is it a blow to Al-Qaeda?
I think it's a blow to Al-Qaeda. I think that the more you see the people who are taking part in these revolutions, the desire for democracy and freedom that they express, they have no interest in Al-Qaeda's message. Al-Qaeda's message is one of hatred. It's one of really a kind of theocratic tyranny. It's not a message of democracy. Al-Qaeda considers democracy an enemy. And there's just very little sign. In fact, there's no sign that I've seen that there's any enthusiasm for Al-Qaeda. The only danger we face right now with regard to Al-Qaeda or any kind of terrorist group is if Libya completely implodes and becomes a failed state, then they're able to take up residence in Libya and operate from there. And that's why the United States has a very profound interest in how Libya turns out. And I think we'll need to get involved, I hope not to a great extent, but possibly more than I think people are imagining now.
States across the country are in fiscal crises, facing difficult cuts to make ends meet. This morning in our studio, we've brought together four of the top governors to discuss some of the excruciating choices they're facing back home. How are the latest rounds of cuts in federal and state spending going to have an impact on things like your children's education, your health care, your jobs? Massachusetts Democrat Deval Patrick, a close friend of President Obama, has just begun his second term in office. South Carolina Republican Nikki Haley, at 39, the youngest governor in the nation, was championed by Sarah Palin and the Tea Party. Colorado Democrat John Hickenlooper, a former Denver mayor and entrepreneur, was just sworn into office last month. And Arizona Republican Governor Jan Brewer has taken some controversial stands on immigration and also made some tough budget cuts to narrow her state's massive budget gap. Governors, thanks so much for being here.
Appreciate it. Good morning.
Let's start with that other uprising, the one in Wisconsin that we've seen. The nation's watched as Governor Scott Walker has sought to not only cut the benefits of state employees, but also restrict their collective bargaining rights. Is this the right move, Governor Haley?
Absolutely. You know, what we have to remember is we appreciate our public employees, but our job as governors is to look after the taxpayer. And he is doing exactly what he promised to do. He is trying to trim his budget. He is trying to make the tough decisions that the people of Wisconsin wanted him to do. What I think is a shame is the fact that you've got Democrat senators who represent the people of Wisconsin that are so cowardly that they left their own state. I think that's an absolute slate of who should be thrown out of office as soon as they get back. It's absolutely unfortunate.
Governor Hickenlooper, you want to weigh in?
Well, you know, when I spent a number of years in the restaurant business, and sometimes we took over failing restaurants, the first thing we did was reach out to the workforce, to the workers, and say, all right, if we got to cut costs and trying to find new ways of making difficult decisions and delivering services with less, you're the ones who have to help us. And I think it's a challenge to have that kind of division and adversarial relationships. Going to make it very tough for them to get to the point where they can make their government smaller and yet more effective.
Governor Patrick, we've made our, if I may, Jay, just on this point, we have made greater accountability in the public schools. We've reformed the pension system. We've rebalanced public employee benefits, health benefits in particular. We have had concessions from labor to wage concessions to help us close the budget. We reformed transportation. All of this with labor at the table. So there's another way to approach that, and we bring a different way, and it's been a successful way.
But speaking of being go ahead.
Well, it's kind of interesting because during these very, very difficult times that all governors are facing throughout the United States is the fact that you have to make some really tough decisions, and employees need to have a personal relationship with their employer. And if we're not able to go in there as governors and be able to make these adjustments during these difficult, difficult times, we will never get our states turned around.
I agree with that. I agree with that. I think my point is simply that we can do this with labor at the table instead of doing it to labor, and we've shown that in messages.
Well, speaking of being at the table, don't you think it's a little cowardly for legislators, Democratic legislators in Indiana and Wisconsin, just to have fled? I mean, that's
not... I try to make a practice of just governing Massachusetts and not trying to govern other
but
states.
But how would you do it if you have a Republican House in Colorado? What would happen if the Republicans in the House just decided they didn't like what you were doing and they were going to Nevada for the week?
I think the key, and again, this is the restaurant background where, you know, you learn real early there's no margin in having enemies, but, you know, we've been trying to reach out to the Republicans from before the inauguration, say, all right, how can we work together? We need your ideas. We've all got... I mean, this country... We shouldn't be talking about, you know, these polarized topics. We should be talking about jobs and how do we all make the investments in education and infrastructure and technology and innovation to move this. I mean, all 50 states, we should be competing against each other to see who can drive our economies the fastest. And, you know, the budget's tough. It's difficult. But if everyone's at the table, we'll get through it.
But let's be clear. This was cowardly. This was irresponsible. They left their state at a time where their state needed them the most because they don't want to take a vote. Whether they are for it or against it, you come back and you represent the people of your state. I think what Governor Walker is doing is showing that he is standing his ground. I talked to him this past week. He is holding strong. I told him the people of this country want him to hold strong. I think what is absolutely shameful is those senators left their state.
But Governor Haley, if I could just follow up for 1 second, there is no correlation, according to statistics, between a state's ability to collectively bargain with its public employees and whether or not they have a budget deficit. You know this firsthand. Your state is a right-to-work state.
That's right.
And in fact, in the New Republic, Joseph McCartan argues, quote, there's no direct correlation between public sector collective bargaining and yawning state budget deficits, according to data gathered by the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. While Wisconsin projects a state budget deficit of 12.8% for 2012, North Carolina, which does not allow government workers to bargain, faces a significantly higher deficit, 20%. Ohio, whose Republican Governor John Kasich has also made clear his desire to roll back collective bargaining, has a deficit that's only about half the size of non-union North Carolina's. Isn't this just a power grab by those who oppose unions?
Absolutely not, because what you're looking at is these employees oppose the health care cuts. They oppose the benefit cuts. So they're saying no to everything. So collective bargaining is a combination of all of that. What he's saying is now more than ever, we've got to get control of our states. We've got to get control of our budgets. This is the time where he's got to make decisions. He's trying to do that. And I think the people elected him to do that.
I think, excuse me, Nikki, yeah, sure. I'm sorry. I just, all of us, as you said, said and as we would all acknowledge, are dealing with these kinds of challenges, trying to get benefits rebalanced, trying to get our budget gaps closed. All I'm saying is there's another way, and we've shown that there's another way. And the leadership I've tried to bring in Massachusetts is about turning to each other instead of on each other. And so we have had labor at the table to move these very issues and had move them successfully.
I think it's despicable, Jake, that you have elected officials in the legislature, and I served in the legislature for 14 years and in part of leadership, that they would leave their job. No one should walk out. They are doing exactly what we ask public employees not to do, and that is to strike, and it is wrong. They need to get back to Wisconsin. They need to go in there, and they need to vote, and it is just so irresponsible. I can't imagine them, any of them, getting reelected. The only thing you go to the legislature with is your vote.
Governor Brewer, I want to ask you a question about the Republicans' effort here in Washington to cut the budget for spending cuts. Their budget allocates $350 million less for border security, fencing, infrastructure, and technology than Congress approved last year. It cuts an estimated $159 million over last year for customs and border protection, modernization and construction programs, and potentially 685 fewer Border Patrol agents than President Obama's budget calls for. Does the House Republicans' budget make Arizona less safe?
I believe that we need as much resources that are necessary to get our borders secured. The bottom line is that the budget hasn't been completed. I'm hopeful that it will be reinstated, the dollars, and I hope that those dollars end up in Arizona and in Texas and in California. But we all know that Arizona is the gateway for illegal immigration and the drug smuggling and the drug cartels, and Arizona is paying a hefty price. Just cumulatively in incarceration, the feds owe us over almost $800 million. And over $1 billion a year just in education and health care. It is out of control, and we are going to continue fighting the battle against what's taking place between our border and Mexico.
I want to ask you about President Obama's proposed budget, which would add $7.2 trillion in debt over the next 10 years. At no point in his 10-year projection would the federal government spend less than it's taking in. Would you ever support a budget like that? What would happen if you brought a budget like that to the legislature and the people of Colorado?
I think there'd be a healthy debate, which I think is what the president is expecting.
A healthy debate, is that what they call it?
But you know, the bottom line, I mean, you know, the dirty four-letter word in all this is math, right? In the end, it does have to add up. The federal government ultimately is going to have to balance their budgets and get back onto a fiscal track. But where you start out is not where you're going to end up. And I think what the president is trying to stress is that we need to invest in our infrastructure. We need to be the best innovation country on earth. We have to, you know, we have to make the appropriate investments. So he's laying out a broad array of, I think, largely really constructive investments: education, mobility and transportation, healthcare, defense. Trying to make sure that we are ready to compete. To win this game. It's a worldwide competition now.
You've proposed more than $300 million in cuts to the public education system in Colorado, K through 12. That's about $500 less per student. President Obama, when talking about his budget cuts, recently said this:
"We can't win the future if we lose the race to educate our children. Can't do it. In today's economy, the quality of a nation's education is one of the biggest predictors of a nation's success."
You're going to lose the future in Colorado?
No, but for 1 year, we're going to have to retrench and say, all right, with less money, how do we still figure out how to raise our kids up? And, you know, oftentimes in business, when you struggle for a year, you come up with ideas or innovations that make you better. And, you know, we've been working with the teachers union, we're working with the entire educational community to say, all right, we don't have a choice, right? 42% of our budget is K-12 education. We've got to make some serious cuts there. How do we do it in such a way that we don't hurt our kids?
You know, Jake, we were talking just before coming in about how, in some respects, the fiscal crisis has presented some real opportunities for us to think in new ways about how government does what we want government to do, and frankly, to ask ourselves, what is it we want government to do and not to? And in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, just like everywhere else, we've had huge budget gaps we've had to deal with, $13 billion of accumulated gaps over the last couple of years. We've closed those gaps now, but at the same time made record-level investments in K-12 support for our public schools, because
That's our investment in the future. And in that respect, the president and I completely agree.
Let's talk for a second. I want to turn to 2012. We only have a couple minutes left, and I want to ask you two questions about 2012.
I am not running. No.
You took over your state from Mitt Romney, who is almost certainly going to run for president. Mm-hmm. Did he do a good job as governor of Massachusetts?
You know, I think one of the best things he did was to be the co-author of our health care reform, which has been a model for national health care reform. We have 98% of our residents insured today.
But you haven't gotten costs under control at all, have you?
It's very, very interesting. Actually, it's added about 1% to our state budget, which is not what is generally reported on out there, but that is the truth. And what these folks did in Massachusetts is frankly the same thing that the Congress did, which was take on access first and come to cost control next. And that's what we're doing right now. We have some very exciting strategies. And just as we have, I think, shown the nation how to provide universal care through a public-private model, I think we can crack the code on healthcare cost control.
So it sounds
like
you think Governor Romney did a pretty good job.
On that one issue, I think he deserves a lot of credit.
Governor Haley, I want you to take a look at this ad.
Nikki Haley supporter, Governor Sarah Palin.
A strong pro-family, pro-life, pro-Second Amendment, pro-development, conservative reformer, your next governor, Nikki Haley.
That was a pretty important endorsement for you. If she runs for president, will you return the favor?
You know, the one thing I've said is I think that the environment's going to dictate who our next president is. I have not in any way plan on endorsing at this point in time at all. I want all of the candidates to come to South Carolina. I want the people of South Carolina to get to see them the way I know them. I want them to campaign hard, and then when the right time comes, I will endorse. But there is no one that I feel like I owe at this time.
After passing a $61 billion budget cut, Congress recessed with talk of a government shutdown still in the air. The members have been in their districts this weekend preparing to come back to Washington to do battle over calls for even deeper cuts in federal spending. Republican leaders know a government shutdown could be playing with political fire, but David Curley caught up with a Tea Party freshman who doesn't seem worried about getting burned.
Lindenhurst, baby!
Ladies and gentlemen!
Hey, guys!
This is what a Tea Party victory lap looks like.
Welcome to a cup of Joe with Joe.
In a barbershop about an hour outside of Chicago, new Republican Congressman Joe Walsh.
I called myself a Tea Party conservative first and a Republican second. Not everybody liked that.
Is back with the faithful for the first time since the big victory.
I believe this country that we love and adore needs a little bit of shock therapy.
But should he stand firm with the government poised to run out of money and shut down this week?
How many people would like me to vote against that, even risking having the government shut down?
Shut it down.
Call the Democrats out on the tactics.
If we ran our households as irresponsibly as the government has been running itself for the last 20 years, we'd be in prison.
For 2 days, we followed the new congressman crisscrossing his district from a steel plant to classrooms and conference rooms as he canvassed his constituents, asking if he's on the right track.
What has been the number one message you've received since you've come home after passing that budget?
Keep cutting, baby. I know you're going to take some hot hits, but you're doing this for the bigger picture.
Emboldened, Walsh is one of the few Republicans who wonders out loud, would a government shutdown really be that bad?
I don't want a government shutdown, but if we have to have one, it might be good for us.
But not everyone is happy with the new congressman and all those cuts. He's challenged at many stops.
Keep talking about deficits, and then you guys went, first thing, give a tax break to the richest people in the nation.
This is a great time to be alive. You know why? Because there's a lot of stuff going on.
But you can't determine that it's a great time to be alive for everybody. You don't know that. You don't know everybody's stories.
This country right now is arguing about and debating, and it's a good thing, big issues.
This week, the big bank, Goldman Sachs, said that the Republican budget cuts could cut our already slow economic growth this year by more than half.
Don't you risk running the country back into a recession?
Not at all. Every dollar we take out of the public sector will go into the private sector, and it will go to grow the economy.
This is one of those rare moments when the American people are asking us to be bold.
Walsh has taken an unusual path to Congress.
Leadership is every bit as conservative as this freshman class is.
After a career in education reform, he failed at raising capital for startup ventures. Financially strained, his house was foreclosed, and the Libertarian ran for Congress.
Look,
I don't hide anything. I don't like what the president's been doing the last 2 years. Duh. That's why I ran. I think we're spending too much money. I want to stop it.
To high school students and CEOs, the message is the same.
This country that we love, feel it. We're going through a revolution right now. It is wonderful.
Walsh joined that revolution by just a couple hundred votes.
Joe Walsh from Illinois.
He sleeps in his Washington office. He refused the federal health care plan. And now he's the subject of Time magazine photo shoots.
Straight ahead, good.
And tells reporters he is truly surprised with the freshman's power.
Based on what I've seen in general, we've held together very, very, very strongly.
Walsh's energetic
you rock.
And impatient style.
So let's be mobile.
Give me quick answers. What do you want your government doing right now to address this problem? Go.
Only seems to endear him to his base, Tea Party members and small business.
Should your congressman and other freshmen at some point compromise with the other side to keep the government running?
No.
That's why you were voted in.
But if everybody else has to cut and live within our means, why shouldn't the government?
Walsh says he may sign on to that compromise to fund the government for just 2 weeks. A short reprieve, he says, from the bigger battle, which he won't shrink from.
Are you going to be a one-hit wonder, one term?
Possibly. And here's why I say that. Every decision I make these next 2 years is going to be to do what I think's right to help save this country fiscally. And if that doesn't get me reelected, so be it.
For this week, I'm David Curley in Fox Lake, Illinois.
So you heard the congressman, Governor Brewer, say that he was willing to shut down the government over this fight, the showdown with the White House and with Democrats over spending cuts. The White House says they will not abide $61 billion in spending cuts in the House Republican bill. Should Republicans be willing to shut down the government?
No, I don't believe so. I think that government is a necessary evil, but we need to continue.
You don't mean evil.
I do. Well, it's necessary. Government is necessary to provide certain services, and they should be able to come to some solution. Bottom line is they need to trim the budget, they need to move on, and they need to get out of our lives as governors in our states. They need to take care of the federal government's responsibilities and let us and give us the flexibility that we need so that we can take care of the people within our states.
Should they risk a shutdown?
I am proud of those congressional Republicans for making those cuts. We have a leader of this country that's got to make some decisions. The people have spoken. No, I don't think government should shut down, but it's up to the president to go and negotiate with the Republicans, not for the Republicans to go and negotiate with the president. They are doing what the people asked. This last election said less dollars, no deficits. Let's start living within our means. I think those Republican congressmen did that. I think the president needs to respond.
Very quickly, Governor.
I think it took 10 years to grow this deficit. A lot of those folks who were saying shut the government down didn't have a word to say when the deficits were being run up through the roof by President Obama's predecessor. I think the president has shown he will and can work with Republicans, but when he reaches out a hand, they need to not slap it. They need to reach back. And act like the adults we've sent and we expect in that building over there.
All right, I'm afraid that's all the time we have.
Hello again from Tripoli. You heard Joe Walsh of Chicago talk about the battle over big ideas and revolution in the air in the United States. Well, the same is certainly true here in this region, and we are covering it all. So stay with ABC News and ABC.com for breaking news coverage, including how long can the Gaddafis hold out here in Tripoli. For me, Christiana Manpour, and for Jake Tapper, thank you for watching, and I'll see you next.